I don't have any disclosures. How many of you have heard about the Framingham Heart Study before? Good. So I'm just going to give a very brief background on it. It started out actually in the beginning in 1948, and the Framingham original cohort was actually from an area that's not too far from where we live right now, in Framingham, Massachusetts, which is about 18 miles west of Boston. So it's a community-based town, supposed to be a typical town in the state of Massachusetts, and they enrolled two-thirds of the town into a study. And that's pretty significant to randomly choose two-thirds of a town and enroll them into a study, which was about 5,200 people in 1948. It was supposed to represent the general population so that maybe you could extrapolate that to other typical towns across the U.S. The ages range between 28 to 62. It was only adults. And they prospectively followed patients. They didn't do anything to them. They just followed them out over time, and they just basically recorded a lot of different things, and they went to see what happened. The main reason why they did this is because they were looking for cardiovascular risk factors. They were trying to understand, why do people get heart disease? Why do they have MIs? Why do they have strokes? And many of the reasons for why we understand this today is because of all of the different studies that have come out from the Framingham Heart Study. So these patients were seen every 2 years, and they came back and they had an extensive examination. It was nice for them in a way because they didn't have to pay for these, and they had a blood work drawn, they had lots of their vitals checked, they went through all kinds of exams under very rigorous research-type methods, and at this point it's the longest-running epidemiological study in the United States. Then, because of additional grants, there is now the Framingham Offspring Study, and it enrolled another 5,000 adult children of the original cohort, including their spouses, because you can't leave the spouses out. And they wanted to look at familial risk factors for heart disease. Now, a lot of other things have been assessed since then, but that was what the primary grants were for. And these patients were seen, or subjects, I should say, were seen every 4 years and went through similar rigorous, extensive testing, blood work, physical exams, and it just depended on whatever the grants were that they had to be able to assess the different factors. And then, believe it or not, there's a Framingham Foot Study. And it didn't happen for a while. So the original one started in 1948. The Offspring Study started in the 1970s. And the Framingham Foot Study started in 2002. But we still have something, and something is better than nothing. And it was with a very smart epidemiologist who actually got a very nice NIH grant to start this. She had no experience from a clinician standpoint, but she knew that collecting foot data was important because it's something that's been often ignored. And actually, almost all of the eligible original cohort and offspring were enrolled, but they obviously still had to be living and cognitively intact for the types of data that they were collecting. In 2004, they had to add an additional community-based sample from Framingham to ensure adequate sample size because of making sure that they're still living and cognitively intact. And they did this by random digit dialing and enrolled about 1,000 more patients or subjects that were over 50 years old but were also ambulatory. And so that comprised the Framingham Foot cohort. So we actually have over 3,000 adults, and of which a third of them have longitudinal data. They've been followed over time for changes in foot problems, which is something that is very difficult to have data on. But this existed because the epidemiologists knew that there's limited data available on foot problems. Everything's been focused on heart and every other type of disease, but generally, historically, foot problems haven't been regarded as an important health risk. It's been anecdotal. But at the same time, we know that foot pain is very common. And in fact, the U.S. Department of Public Health has seen that foot symptoms are among one of the top 20 reasons for why a patient will actually go to a physician among ages 65 to 74. That's a huge number of patients that are going to see their primary care physician to seek help. And we also, it's pretty much agreed upon that women have more foot pain than men for whatever reason, but we see it clear across every study practically. And we do know that osteoarthritis is more common in women. And in fact, The number four place for osteoarthritis is the location of the foot. And women over the age of 65 have more foot pain and have been shown to have more bunion deformities across many different studies. So the purpose of collecting all this data on these subjects in Framingham, Massachusetts, was to first just identify and examine the prevalence and pattern of foot disorders and foot pain in this just random sample of a population-based study. And then to take it a step further, and after we start to examine the prevalence and the pattern of foot deformity and pain, to look at how that might impact limitations and disability, inability to maintain activity, inability to walk, inability to potentially have fall risk factors in going forward. This is sort of the overall pathway. We have different risk factors. You can see whether they're harmful or protective is up to for debate. But there's lots of different risk factors that happen to patients over time, and they impact the way that the foot functions, whether it's a malalignment problem, whether it's a biomechanic issue, or something else. And those abnormal factors, those abnormal factors then lead to foot pain or abnormal function, which could then lead to an disturbance in gait, which then could lead to disability, difficulty to maintain activity, and even falls. So you're probably thinking, yeah, that seems like common sense, that biomechanic factors affect lower extremity function, can lead to disability and pain. That makes sense to us because we see that in our day-to-day lives. But we need this in data to be able to show our policymakers and our stakeholders and other people that are making decisions as we shape healthcare and healthcare reform in the United States, to show that foot deformities and foot pain do have a large impact on our country's ability to maintain their activity and reduce their disability. So like all of the different qualities that are part of Framingham data, the Framingham foot data is also collected with very rigorous attention to quality. Everything is a complete process to be able to approve by the Framingham Monitoring Board. And what we're trying to do is identify links from modifiable foot problems and try to prevent other issues from happening. So we're preventing problems from happening and how we may modify our therapy. So there are lots of core examination questions that every patient goes through, whether it's asking about their age, their sex, their smoking status, alcohol, depression scales, physical activity scales. They measure many different things at baseline on everyone. But in addition to that, the Framingham Foot Study, they have questionnaires that are specific for foot problems. They have a validated physical exam that was performed by a trained examiner for foot disorders. They took digital pictures of feet to be able to compare to any questionable exam findings, and they had a medical advisory panel along with a podiatrist who would go and then say, yes, this is hallux valgus, or yes, or no, it's not, if it was anything that was borderline. And we actually have performance measures. Patients were measured when they were standing on a tech scan mat or also walking. So we have a lot of data that has been collected, and it's still being put into a format that can be analyzed. So this is one of the first studies that we've participated in, and we started out very simple, where we looked at risk factors for hallux valgus within this cohort. We chose this because hallux valgus is a very common foot deformity that everyone sees, and it's also more common in older adults. We wanted to look for risk factors that may be associated with hallux valgus, just so we can describe it better. This is the town square of Framingham. Of course, when we got involved with this project, we were excited, so we went and took pictures of Framingham. But this is a cross-sectional study of over 3,400 ambulatory adults from this town. The primary aim was to identify risk factors associated with hallux valgus in this large cohort. And we hypothesized there would be many risk factors associated with hallux valgus. And some of them that were available to us to study were age, BMI, whether or not they had foot pain. We looked at high heel use and pes planus. So with these different potential risk factors that were available to us, I want to just briefly describe how these were identified in these patients. So starting with the outcome of hallux valgus, it was identified through a validated foot exam. And this exam was created and captured 20 common clinical conditions of the foot. And it's based on being able to do this very quickly and very efficiently by somebody that you can train that has some medical background. So patients were standing when they had their examination, and a trained examiner would compare their feet to a photo that they had in their binder that showed a hallux deviating towards the lesser toes by about 15 degrees with respect to the first metatarsal. And that's how they determined whether or not there was hallux valgus. If there was question, the photos would then be compared with the medical panel to make a judgment call. No x-rays were taken in this phase of the study. The validated foot exam went through quite a bit because it really didn't exist prior to Framingham foot. So there had to be pilot studies that were performed just to be able to collect this data. So there were multiple pilot studies performed looking at inter and intra observer reliability to make sure that they felt like you could identify hallux valgus in this method. And it did get the Framingham stamp of approval, which is not easy to obtain. So we do know that although you may disagree with the methods on how they determined hallux valgus, it was the best thing that they could do in a quick, efficient manner. The way that they defined pes planus was more complicated because they actually decided to use foot pressure data because they felt like it was more reliable than looking at an exam like hallux valgus. And so they took patients that were standing on tech scans and they were barefoot in resting calcaneal stance position. And they estimated different biomechanic measures, of which is how they determined pes planus. With the MAT scans, they had fair reliability, and they were all calibrated at least daily and prior to any data collection. And with pes planus, it was defined by using the Staehele index. And the Staehele index is when you take the pressure MAT scan and you take the minimum arch width divided by the maximum rear foot width. And if the ratio of the arch width to the rear foot width is greater than 75%, then they were classified as having pes planus. And there were even studies that had to be performed to look at that reliability, and that inter-rater and inter-reliability was very high. So it got the Framingham stamp of approval on how to define pes planus in a large epidemiologic-type study. Foot pain was not determined like this, but would have been more interesting. They just asked, on most days, do you have pain, aching, or stiffness in either foot, yes or no? And it was the patient or subject just saying, yes, I do, or no, I don't. For past high heel use, they asked women if they wore high heels between the ages of 20 to 64. If they never wore them, if they sometimes wore them, or if they always wore them. It was just a simple self-report of what they told us. For the statistical analysis, because we were looking at whether or not they had hallux valgus, yes or no, we did a multivariate logistic regression. We stratified by gender because we already know that gender is an effect modifier, meaning that women have more hallux valgus than men. So we stratified from the very beginning because we already know that that's a risk factor. We adjusted for confounders and reported odds ratios, and anything less than a p-value of 0.05 was considered statistically significant. So this is what the demographics look like. Mean age of those in the Framingham foot was 66 years old. They ranged from 39 to 99 years old. If you look on the bottom part of the screen, this is it broken down by decade, which is how it was actually analyzed because you have to have a certain distribution in order to analyze it the right way. And so you can see here there was very few people in the 40-year-old decade, and then it increased during each one and then tapered back down as you got older. Gender, this is a big distinction between most studies that we have available to us versus what's in the Framingham foot data, is that most of the studies report what came into your office. And those are patients that are already having foot problems. You're not capturing all those other people that aren't having foot problems or don't see a physician for whatever reason. And so you can see here that male and female is actually fairly similar, and it's one of the only epidemiologic type studies that have a large proportion of males in their study. The mean weight was 173 pounds and ranged anywhere from 79 to 376 pounds. And as you can guess, the prevalence of foot deformities was very high. And there's already been studies looking at prevalence of foot deformities. And there was only 8% of this population that did not have a foot deformity, which is, I think, a very interesting finding, that most people have a foot deformity. And relevant to this particular study, the prevalence of hallux valgus was almost 40%. That's very high. And the overall prevalence of pes planus was 31%. That's also very high. So we know that these problems are very common. Again, we stratified by gender. And you can see here that women had more bunion deformities than men, which is what we see in our practice and what we see in many other studies. But that's also what we found in this large population-based study that had almost equivalent amounts of men and women in their study. So when you stratify by males and females, when you look at age, now again, keep in mind the mean age of this patient cohort is 66, but we found in females that there was a greater odds of having hallux valgus as you age. If you look at BMI, it was an opposite finding. We actually found that the odds was reduced by having an association with a higher BMI was associated with decreased odds of having hallux valgus. And that was statistically significant. When you looked at the relationship between foot pain and hallux valgus, we found that both foot pain and hallux valgus were associated in men and women. With pes planus, only women we found an association with hallux valgus and the presence of pes planus. In past high heel use, it didn't matter if they reported that they sometimes wore high heels or always, both had a greater odds of having hallux valgus associated with them. So to put this in perspective, first of all, just looking at age, we found that older age in women was a greater odds. It was a small odds increase, but it was still statistically significant. But if you look at the cohort that we have available to us, remember the Framingham Foot Study started in 2002. So only 4% of those that are in this study are less than 50 years old. That means everyone else is greater than 50 years old. So if you already have hallux valgus existing by the time you're that age, you're not going to be able to detect an increase in prevalence of hallux valgus going forward. So that's why, potentially why the study did not detect much of an odds increase, and we didn't detect an odds increase in men at all. When you look at BMI, it was an interesting finding that greater BMI, BMI greater than 30, was actually associated with a decreased odds of having hallux valgus. I mean, we're not really sure why, and I think additional follow-up studies would be relevant in this case. It could be that those patients were more sedentary over time, so looking at their physical activity scores and other things can be explored in the future, or their shoe preference. Perhaps they had more protective risk factors in their lifestyle choices that didn't lead to hallux valgus. I don't think we would say that higher BMI is recommended, but that's what we found in this study. Foot pain was associated with hallux valgus, and the reason why that's significant, although we know that hallux valgus is associated with foot pain, there's many people that don't have foot pain that have hallux valgus. So your odds of having pain is greater if you have hallux valgus, and that's something we can take to primary care physicians and others to say that no, although there are a lot of people that don't have pain with hallux valgus, the majority do, and it is a risk factor. We also found that there was an 86% greater odds of hallux valgus in women if they had pes planus, and then high heel use. Even sometimes or always, it was either 43, 44% greater odds of having hallux valgus. The one thing that you have to keep in mind is the available data that we have at this point is not longitudinal, meaning we don't have access yet to the data of looking at patients as they follow through over time. We only have data as one slice, so a cross-section of it. So we don't know if there was pain first that then led to hallux valgus, or if hallux valgus causes pain, or a combination. You can't sort that out with the data that we have. And that's the same thing with pes planus. We don't know if there were more patients that had pes planus that then led to hallux valgus, or if it was Hallux valgus leading to pes planus, or they were born with both. We don't know that with this data. And the same thing with high heels. We don't know if wearing high heels caused Hallux valgus, or if for some reason those that have Hallux valgus tend to wear more high heels. It's possible for both factors, but we don't really know. But we know that there's an association. So the limitations are that this is a cross-sectional study, but the solution that we have going forward is that we're hoping to apply for grants where we can utilize the longitudinal data to see if we can test out these associations further. The definitions for Hallux valgus, pes planus, foot pain, you may come up with ways to identify that in a more effective manner for you. It's not the same. You can't identify these problems the same as if you would in your clinic, because these are patients coming in and getting, you know, 4 hours of physical exam tests and other things going on. The only way you're going to be able to test foot data is to have something very quick and efficient. And if you try to tag other things on, the monitoring board will not allow that because they're protecting the patients from going through too many tests. So this is an epidemiologic type study. It has to be fast and cost efficient. And I don't think that there's one measure that can perfectly and accurately measure all of these different foot deformities. But they did do reliability studies to assess that it was reliable enough. And as we see more data, we're going to try to confirm these findings. Generalizability is a problem with anything with the Framingham heart study, foot study, any of the Framingham studies, because most of Framingham, Massachusetts is Caucasian. And so what we've done is we've actually teamed up with another large cohort in a different area to try to reconfirm these findings in a more diverse population. Multiple testing is always a possibility when you do any of these types of tests. So you don't always use the p-value as your only criteria for judging if it's significant to you. But we only ran one model, and that does reduce multiple testing type 1 error. There may be additional confounders, and I can think of many that I would like to assess further. We just didn't have access to that data yet because this was a non-funded study. But it will be interesting to look at that as we move forward. Missing data, there was some missing data, whether patients withdrew or they died or other reasons, but it was a very small proportion. Most of these patients were actually very compliant and followed through with the Framingham study, which is what makes this so interesting. And we also modeled this with sensitivity analyses to see if it changed our results, and it did not. So in conclusion, this is a very large community-based study. And it provided us with some initial essential information looking at the relationship between a very common foot disorder, Hallux valgus, and potential risk factors that are associated with that. And in fact, we found a very strong association between Hallux valgus and pain in both men and women. But just in women alone, we found even more potential risk factors that were associated with that. And that included older age, wearing high heels, whether it was sometimes or always during the ages of 20 to 64, and whether or not they also had pes planus. So there are some future public health efforts that you could probably think of that could try to target the modifiable risk factors that are associated with Hallux valgus. So I want to just thank you for inviting us here today and letting us share some of the work that we've been doing. And I'm looking forward to this next year, and thank you for putting your trust in me as being your chair. I'm chair-elect right now, but I really appreciate all the assistance and all the experience that others have provided me. So I'm happy to entertain any questions that you have. Yes?
Any thoughts on why pes planus would be a factor in women and not men?
We were looking at that a little bit closer, and there, it's possible that men had pes planus at a different age. So it was, in other words, we're not really sure why, but there's a lot of different things that you could look for. For example, we're looking at equinus as one of the possibilities moving forward, trying to see if that could sort out pes planus and Hallux valgus and equinus. But they didn't define equinus in any effective way. It was very hard for them to assess equinus. We have some ideas on how to do it.
We think part of this can be explained, or at least there's some analogy here, with the fact that people who wore high heels on a regular basis had a very greater incidence of the Hallux valgus, and because of that, we know that can lead to a greater incidence of equinus deformities hormonal changes which increase laxity within ligaments and tendons and so on that may have pushed them over during that time period, because they're also exposed to greater weight gain at that time.
And they actually collected a lot of this data that is now starting to become available, but you have to have grant support before they will allow you access to it. They're very protective of their data, which they should be, otherwise people could go crazy with this. But there's hormonal issues. We would like to look at a lot of different other confounders, and I think that if we sort through those, it's very possible that we may also find that men with pes planus and hallux valgus have a significant association once we start to sort through all those other issues. Because we were only able to look at age. We already stratified by gender. We looked at pes planus and pain. What was the other ones?
We just BMI.
BMI.
And then you also had the presence of foot pain.
Right.
Yeah, because unfortunately, with the TechMap data, you're not really determining whether they have a functional pes planus or like a fixed pes planus.
No.
Which would probably be interesting to see, because you know the whole biomechanical theory of the hypermobile first grade, that's why you're developing the hallux valgus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it doesn't really, from this, you would think, well, if men had pes planus, there'd be a relationship with hallux valgus as well.
Absolutely. And with the definition of pes planus, we've been thinking about other ways to define it. This was how the epidemiologists defined pes planus. And as you can see, you may disagree with that definition and may come up with better ways to define it. And we do have now walking data, ambulatory data from the tech scan mats, which may be more valuable to us. It's just very time consuming to analyze all of that data in over 3,500 individuals over, and then multiple times as they come every 4 years or every 2 years. So it's an incredible amount of work, and the people that are actually analyzing the ambulatory data right now have a grant for whatever they're specifically working on, and that alone is taking them about 3 or 4 years just for their own study. But I think there are definitely better ways to define pes planus, and the reason why they chose that way is because they could do it very quickly.
I think probably one of the more pertinent aspects of the institute, did I just step out of the way? Huh? Oh, I didn't know if they did. I think one of the more pertinent points here in terms of preventive medicine is that this study does show that patients with a bunion have a higher risk of developing pain later on. And so since we're catching these people later on in life, there's that higher odds of having pain. And so I think we can go to primary care physicians, we can go to patients and say with some certainty that the bunion may not be bothering you right now necessarily, but we know that over time, we're going to see that this will become more, the odds are this will be much more painful for you.
Because the mean age was 66, and only 4% were under the age of 40. Most patients were over that, which in a way that's also very valuable information because we're studying an older cohort of patients, and you see what has happened with their feet during that time period.
What data, Dr. Hannon, what has she already looked at? Like,
She's Hebrew.
Okay.
Well,
so what has she done so far? Like, I mean, this has been data available. I remember trying to contact her years ago, trying to get involved, but she wasn't full.
It's very restrictive.
Yeah.
It is very hard to work with the group, but there are ways. They've done a little bit where they've looked at the prevalence of foot deformities and just basically provided a description. Here are all the deformities that we saw. And they tried to look at some associations. And what they found was that they were running into issues on trying to explain their associations. And that's when they realized that they needed somebody with some experience with foot and ankle expertise in order to help guide them into just finding just, you know, strange associations versus stuff that's actually clinically relevant and meaningful to us on how we can look at modifying different risk factors for problems. And that's sort of how we became involved, was when they eventually determined that they needed more expertise in that regard. Because prior to that, it was all non-clinicians involved with this. Any other study or questions?
I just have a question in terms of the continuing data that's being collected. So, I mean, they're still bringing these people in, obviously qualified by, you know, they're still living and still can answer questions.
It just depends. They're letting us do, they've given us access to do some very small, simple pilot studies like this to help us sort of build some background with it. And their intent is for us to apply for grants. And once we receive grants, then, because we can't, even though we can analyze the data ourselves, they won't allow us to. We have to use the Framingham biostatisticians, for example. And even all of this, we weren't allowed to analyze. And I caught some mistakes earlier, and I couldn't even fix it. I had to then go back to the biostatisticians. Then they freaked out and then fixed it very quickly, and it went from there. But they are very selective and very restrictive. And going forward, they've collected all of this information. They have a ton of data, for example, on the tech scans with walking. It's just there being collected. And in fact, that other cohort that we're teaming up with a more diverse population, they even are collecting x-rays, which is going to be really interesting for us, because then we can sort of confirm some of these findings with something much more specific. But it's all there. It's just a matter of work power, of analyzing it and putting it into a form that can be assessed.
We could spend our whole career on
this. You could. You really could.
Are they open to you adding?
You absolutely can, but you've got to have the grant support, because we asked about that, and it was interesting.
Currently, we're trying to come up with some workarounds so that we can apply the data that's already there and use it, because it's a very rich resource. And so I think that there's a way for us to be able to go back, looking at the tech scan information, we can define certain things. Basically just retroactively, if they meet certain criteria. I think that we'll be able to define Aquinas based on peak pressure time intervals, based on the dynamic tech scans they have. It's just a matter of diving into it and coming up with a way to correlate it with people moving forward. But that's what we would do.
Utilizing the data they've already collected, because it's much more work to try to take the data they've collected and then change it in a way so that you can make a new definition. But if you can use something that they've already defined, but then realize that that might be measuring something else like equinus, then that's a much easier thing to convince them with, because the other would be very expensive to do. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the other interesting thing is that more diverse cohort that we teamed up with are using the Nova scans, which have a much greater reliability. So our plan at some point would be to, whatever we find in the Framingham foot data, is to confirm it with the x-rays in this other cohort with the Nova scan, which is sort of like the Cadillac of looking for stance and dynamic gait measurements.